Good evening, everyone. This is Lou speaking, and you're tuned to Spotlight, the interview show which appears on For the People twice a month, hopefully, in which we discuss and we interview interesting people from all walks of life. But before we get into that, I want to thank Jennifer Button for her active support and creation, and my partner, Beck Butner, Buck, who arranges interviews and helps with production details. Also, tonight we have such an individual who began in relative poverty and actually pulled himself up by his bootstraps. No particular advantages, just gut, determination, and a lot of personality. A personality which reached out to people, which was effective, making him success in his business, and it's going to be a surprise to all of you. Quietly effective in the political arena as advocate for blind rights in the state of Maine. That's not something he likes to talk about because he's modest, he is humorous, and he's a good old down East Yankee. And having fared from that part of the country, Massachusetts to be exact, I have a special place in my heart for people from New England. Now, without any further ado, I want to present to you a man who you've heard on the afternoon chats, who has quiet humor and a dry humor, and always has an interesting comment to make, Uncle G. Are you there, Uncle G? Are you there, Uncle G? Or did I lose you in cyberspace?
Well, I couldn't get the key, Lou, for one thing. Another thing, after that introduction, I wasn't sure who you was talking about. If you was talking about me or who you was talking about. Yeah, I'm here, Lou.
Well, Uncle G, if the key stuck, it's probably my fault, and I don't know that you have a twin brother, so it's you I'm talking about. Good morning. Begin by filling in a little of your early years in Skowhegan, Maine, a town which, when you were growing up, was slowly declining. The industry had moved out, the textile industry had moved out, your parents were struggling to bring up a family. Could you give a sense of what it grew up in central Maine in the 1930s, 40s, 50s?
Well, it's like you said, it was a small town, about 8,000 people. And it was a good place to grow up, no doubt about that. And went to school there, public school, went to private school, went to the parochial school there. Brought up by the nuns, and if any of you people are familiar with that, you know what kind of an upbringing that is. Then went to public high school, and like, a lot of blind people, you know, you're in denial. All you want to do is be one of the crowd, and, so you don't want any help, so you do it on your own. Well, I did it on my own. Not easy. However, but I made it.
If you don't think I'm too personal, you had some vision at that time, and over the years it slowly declined to next to nothing. Is that right?
That's right, Lou. It's RP, for those who are familiar with RP. It's progressive. Some people, it doesn't show up till later in life, but those of us who aren't so lucky, it shows up earlier, and it did. I think I go back to my first record of appointments with the eye doctor was 7 years old, so, I've been bothered with it for some time.
And growing up in central Maine, there really wasn't many doctors who knew much about it or could do much for it at that time. Is that right?
Oh, I don't think there was any doctors anywhere that could do it, and I don't know if there is today, as far as that goes. There's not. They're doing research on it now, of course, but no, there's, you know, it's one of those things that it's genetic is the term, and it, you know, there's no cure for it.
Well, you graduated from high school in Skowhegan, and that didn't offer many opportunities for either sighted or blind people, but you did something. You left. Where did you go?
Well, to start with, I went to work in the shoe shop right there in Skowhegan. Did that for, well, nearly 10 years. Then the vision got bad enough, so it, and, you know, they kept promising, oh, we'll find something for you, but after a while, you get to the point where you know that that's not going to happen. They don't really want you there. You're going to get hurt, and there's all this machinery in there. So then I wrote a letter to the Division of Rehab and went through that process. Went to New England Rehab for, which was an education for, they call it work evaluation. Was there for 8 weeks. They decided I ought to have probably a vending stand, because there wasn't a lot to offer them days to blind people, because there wasn't, you know, we didn't have this computer and all the access equipment that you've got today, which opens up a lot more fields. So anyway, that's how I wound up with the vending stand program.
Well, your choices at that point were vending stand or what, a sheltered workshop for the blind? Why did you choose the vending stand? Why didn't you just slide into the blind workshop and relax?
Well, because, Lou, I had a Social Security check at that time was something like $85 a month, and there was too much out there in this world that I wanted, that I knew I wasn't going to get on Social Security. So the answer was to work. That's what I wound up doing.
Yeah, you wanted to work, you wanted to accomplish something, and you took the only avenue open to you at that time. Where did it begin? Where did this vending business, where did it begin?
Well, you know, the vending stand began in the State House. I got a stand in the State House. And I came in May. Well, the legislature session had just broke up. So in May, they gave me till the next January to kind of get accustomed to what I was doing there. I had 4 days of training in that stand. I didn't have a clue what I was doing. Well, boy, I sure was glad the legislature wasn't in at that time. Well, anyway, it gave me the time to doing. And it also gave me a time to meet a lot of people. And there again, it's not what you know, it's who you know. And you get to meet the gals that work in the governor's office, secretary of state's office. Then in the fall, the legislature starts having meetings, committee meetings, where they come in. And then you start meeting some of them. And then you get to find out who your friends are, who you can plan on, who you can depend on. You know who to call Senator, and you know who to call Louie or Paul, or, you know, you get that feeling for it. There are some, you know, that insist on being senators. They don't have, once they're elected, they don't have any other name but senator. So that was an education, too, for me. That was a learning experience.
So the stand was in the main legislative building. You only had a few days of training. You didn't know. Did you know how to keep books? Probably not. Did you know how to control stock inventory? Probably not. You learned all on your own.
Oh yeah, it was OJT. It was on the job training, Lou. No question about it. But as I say, I had from May till about at the end of November, 1st of December, to really get, to know what I was doing. And in the meantime, when I was at New England Rehab, I met some people, and I wound up with the Maine Fraternal Association, which is the oldest organization of blind, not for blind, but of blind people in the country. It's now the ACB of Maine, but back in them days it was the Maine Fraternal Association. Got involved with them. Got on the executive committee. And, of course, being in Augusta in the State House, it made them a pretty good lobby.
We'll get into that in a minute. I just want to sort of flesh out the career as a vending stand operator. You ran that stand for how many years, and then what did you do?
Well, I was up there for a year and a half, and it was one of those deals, well, some of you might remember, that they didn't like to give blind people too much room because they weren't mobile enough. So it was an overgrown closet, that's what it was, that I had up the State House. And geez, during legislation, you had to bring things in the back door and pretty near push them out over the counter because you didn't hardly have room to set them down in the place. And that's the way I operated for a session of the legislature. And then I got an opportunity. They built a brand new stand over across the street in the Human Services building. Supervisor wanted to know if I'd be interested, and I, of course, I didn't know what to do because everything's a gamble. I knew I could make a living at the State House, such as it was. I mean, you worked like heck in the wintertime when the session was in, and you didn't do anything in the summertime just with the employees there. So anyway, he took me over there and showed me the sneeze, and the space was tremendous compared to what I had. I just couldn't say no. But like I said, there was a gamble. I didn't know whether I was going to make a living over there or not, but there again, we have to take some chances, and sometimes they work, sometimes they don't, but I found that about 95% of the time when we make a decision and go with it, it works out.
The Maine legislature meets every 2 years, I believe, isn't that right? So your income was not all that great, right? That was better?
Oh, well, they met every year, Lou. They do now, but they used to meet once a year, but on the off year they had what they call special session, which was a short session. They were only in there a few months, but they met every year, so that wasn't a problem. No, it used to be right. I didn't have any problem up there, like I said, as far as money goes. But like I told you in previous conversations that I met some people that were real, real helpful in getting legislation passed. And, I don't know whether I was, helpful in doing it, but I like to think it was anyway. But I knew some of the people that I thought could help us, and they did.
Okay. And towards the end of your working career, you worked for the Department of Child Welfare, I think it was. We can get into that later. But my shift now into your advocacy for blind rights, the state of Maine. So you work for the, you are a member of the Maine Fraternal Order there, of the blind. Did you get into that for social reasons, or did you get into that to do something constructive?
Well, when I first got into it, Lou, I just got into it because that's where a lot of blind people were, and they were working to improve a lot of the blind. And like I said, as fate had it, I wound up in the State House in Augusta, and an executive board member of the association there, and so I think it was, like I said, I made a good lobby for him, and I got, this was a relationship I had. They had what they call legislative research, And they drafted all the legislation. Everything had to go through that office before it went to the legislature. And they made sure it was written, you know, was worded correctly and all that stuff. So we'd get together, the Fraternal Association, and we'd say, you know, we got to have, let's say, two new mobility instructors or whatever the case may be. So we'd say, okay, let's go for it. So, we'd draft something roughly. And I got to know the fellows in the legislative research office, and then they'd come to the counter there every day, and I'd say, hey, Sam, we got to have some legislation. And his answer would be, what do you guys want? And I said, this is what we want, and I'd hand him the draft we had. He'd look at it and say, come on up to my office, 1 o'clock. So I'd go up, and we'd talk it over. He'd draft it up and bring it back. So you guys go over this and see what you think. So we'd go over it and make any adjustments that might have to be made. I'd bring it back a couple days later and say, here it is, Sam. This is what we want. And he'd look at it and say, got to have a sponsor. I'd say, well, I'll find one. You write it up and I'll find one. So anyway, I got to know some of the legislators. One guy had been in the House for over 20 years, you know, had quite a lot of influence, and so he'd come to the counter, and I'd say, hey, Louie, Sam's got a bill that we're trying to get through there, and he says, you got to have a sponsor. Tell him put it in my box. And that's the way we did it. That's the way we got legislation introduced.
Yeah, I'm sure that that's quite surprising to people who are listening to this, how things really get done, not just in the state of Maine, and not just with you and your organization, but a lot of other places, too, informally, quietly, effectively. How did you react to the blind advocacy movement and blind consumer organizations that arose in the 50s and, well, 40s, 50s, and 60s? You're involved with that?
Well, yeah, I was, you know, this is another thing I wanted to bring out about knowing people. In 1965, I was between the time I got out from New England Rehab and the time I got the stand, it was a couple of years. So in 1965, they sent me down to what was in the Maine Institute for the Blind, which was a sheltered workshop. He said, you go down there, give me something to do. So that's what just what it was a sheltered workshop. And geez, I was always kneeling. I'm about to, you know, this stuff ain't gonna last, this making brooms and caning chairs. You guys ought to be getting some government contracts. And, oh, geez, they didn't like that. I was a wave maker. And geez, they didn't, you know, troublemaker is all I was. Well, I guess probably it was. So anyway, they asked me to leave. I was there from January to October. I shot my mouth off enough, so they asked me to leave. So I did. So then, of course, when I got in the State House, as I said, I got to know some of these people. Back in those days, there was an 11-man board of directors down there, and 5 of the board members were appointed by the governor. And 4 were elected by the board, and they had 1 ex officio member, which was the Commissioner of Education. So, anyway, I wound up in the State House. So one day, I'm going to the bank, and I'm standing on the corner waiting for traffic, and one of the girls in the governor's office comes up beside me and says, let me see, how's she? You just got approved by the governor's council. I said, for what? She said, well, you're on the board of directors of the Maine Institute for the Blind. Whew. If you don't think that didn't start a war.
Well, tell us about when you went down there and were essentially the overseer of the man who had dismissed you or kicked you out. So tell us that story, how now the roles were reversed. You are on top, and he had to answer to you, and the board
Well, he was the treasurer. He was also a board member. He was treasurer. And he's the one that was responsible for my leaving. But now I come into the meeting, and I'm on the board, you see. I'm his equal now. And the first thing he did was resign. And then a few others resigned. And then there was a lots of changes made down there. And finally, we got that shelter. Well, we didn't get the shelter. Well, we got the boom making check-in. And we finally got that thrown out of there.
So when you're on the board at the Maine Institute for the Blind in Portland, you really revamped that whole institution regarding how it handled blind people, what it gave them as training. You're quite influential in that area, right?
Yeah, I like to think that we were, of course, with some help. We had, you know, there were other board members, a few, and like I said, there were some awful changes made in the board. After a while, there was no more appointments. They were all elected, and they expanded the board to about 25 people. And we got some, you know, some people on there that didn't have that paternalistic thing. That, you know, this is what I was told. That you fellas, you're warm, and you got, you know, plenty to eat. It's like, what more do you want? Well, you know, I told them I want the same things you want, you know, because they didn't think I was entitled to that because I was blind, you know. But anyway. Yeah, we got a new director, a new executive director, and they turned things. They got government contracts to start. They still had the sheltered workshop, but it wasn't brooms and stuff. It was government contracts, Navy neckerchiefs and flyers kit bags and stuff like that. Now they don't have a workshop there at all. They've done away with the sheltered workshop. And they got computer classes and a couple of apartments there that... you know, independent living type apartments where they take people. So it's changing. It's, you know, it's an evolution. Slow, but it's changing.
But certainly you had an important part in changing that organization to do more constructive things. What I'd like to move to now is something that it's hard to pin down. I mean, here, you came from a rural background. You didn't take courses in relations and influence people, how to win friends, influence people. You didn't do any of that. That came from you. What was your feeling? Were you conscious when you were in that stand, meeting those legislators, that, you know, if I project a positive image here, I might be able to get something done? How did they react to you?
Oh, I think... you know, like any group would, Lou. Some didn't have any problem with it, and some did. But, like I said, it's not long before you figured out, you know, I think I won a few over while the time I was there. I think I convinced a few that blind people could work, and, you know, they used to ask me, you know, these vending stands, are they helpful? I said, what do you mean, are they helpful? Of course they're helpful. It's the difference between the living and welfare, you know. Of course they're helpful. And like I said, I had one fellow I think of especially. He would stick his head in the door every morning and say, good morning, boss. And I'd say, hey, Paul, don't forget whatever the LD number would be. You know, we'd have a bill in, say, 982. Don't forget LD 982. And Paul says, if I vote for that, is that going to help you guys? I said, yes, it is. Okay, boss. And, you know, those bills always passed.
Yeah, that's the point I want you to make. You worked behind the scenes quietly. You didn't march. You didn't yell. You didn't write letters to the newspaper. But you got everything done that you needed to get done. And you did it, your approach people, outreach to, how important that is, blind people, to reach out to the sighted public and win over.
Oh, hell, it's very important. I mean, we're living with them. It's part of the community. Of course you got to reach out to them. You got to, oh, sure. And there's one thing I want to point out, talking legislation, that there are two types of bills. that you want, that everybody wants to remember if they get involved with this. One's money bills and one is non-money bills. And then those are two different animals altogether. And when you get money bills in there, why, you want to get to know the chairman and so forth of the Appropriations Committee. Because they're the ones that's going to make that. In Maine, there's an overriding law that you can pass all the legislation you want. If the money's not there to fund it, the bill is dead. So it's very important to know people, mostly chairman, of the Appropriations Committee, because when the legislature is done and they go home, this Appropriations Committee sits down and they say, okay, we've got, so I'll just roughly say we got $28,000, but we got $100,000 of requests here. Now we got to divide this money up somehow. And this is when the lobbying and the work comes in.
You became a member of the NFB, the National Federation for the Blind, and you were important in the state of Maine. And then later you broke away, you fell away. Without putting you on the spot, obviously, would you tell us why you left that organization? Was it because it projected an image of us, the blind, against sighted, and later blind against other blind organizations, the ACB? Could you go into that in some detail?
Well, it was quite simple. I mean, the philosophy, my philosophy and their philosophy was quite different. Those who are familiar with it, they know that their philosophy is let's not negotiate. You know, it's all confrontation. Well, inevitably, if you're going to solve problems, you've got to sit down and talk to it. You can't do it from outside, walking back and forth out on the street. You've got to do it inside. And that's always been my philosophy. That's why we've always had people on the Citizens Advisory Council, the State of Maine Citizens Advisory Council, to the Division of Eye Care, or the Division of the Blind and Special Services, so that we can make our feelings known to them. And this has worked real well for us. I think we've been, you know, when we go to the legislature, they're aware. We've tried to be reasonable, for one thing. We know that there's not money enough there to do all the services that we need. But when you go there, you know, you got to make them think that this is important to us. And if you go up there and you got, say, three positions that you want filled, you go up there and you fight like hell for them three, but you know when you go up there that if you get two, you'll be happy. And you go back next time, get the rest of it. And that's what we've done. And I think we've been quite successful.
Now, when you say we, are you talking about the NFB? Are you talking to the ACB? Are you talking about the main fraternal group there of the blind? Who are you talking about when you say we?
Well, I was talking about when I was in the main fraternal and the American Council. Rise again, when you talk about NFB, they're out there, you know, they're doing the walking back and forth outside. Yeah, they like to do that for some reason. I'm talking about the organized blind, which was in the main fraternal and then later the main something else. Now the American Council of the Blind. And we always worked with we'd sit down between with the state agency, and they'd tell us. They was quite honest with us. They say, hey, look, we need three positions, or we need these four positions, or what. Now, we can't get them because we're bureaucracy, and they won't listen to us, but you guys are out there, you know, and they'll listen to you. And this is how we operated. And like I said, we met that with some success. No, the Federation, I wasn't in there too long. I went to the convention one year in New York, and I got a feeling for the philosophy there, and that wasn't my philosophy. And, we had a state convention here, and they sent some people up here to do anything but stir everything up. And I know some of you people may not believe this, but Mark Mauer, who's the president of NFB, slept in the room right next door here to me when he came up here to one of our conventions. You know, we had quite a discussion here. We spent about 2 o'clock one morning discussing the NFB. So I got a pretty good feeling for the philosophy.
Well, you had met Dr. Jernigan. You had Mark Moyer as a house guest. So you knew these people. Now you're talking about your philosophy was different from theirs. Would you care to tell us how it was different? What you found so, confining in the philosophy of the NFE? Tell us what your philosophy is.
Yeah, well, again, like I said, their approach to things is, it's always confrontational. In other words, you know, if there's an agency and they don't control it, then it's not being run right. That's the feeling I got from them. You know, they want to control everything, and I don't have that feeling. I don't think that you have to be blind to be able to serve the blind. I think there are people that are sighted, that are well suited to serving the blind. You find some that aren't, but then you find some blind people that aren't too, as far as I'm concerned. Like I said, it's just a whole philosophical difference, your whole approach to things.
So what you're saying here, which is quite interesting, is that you don't have to be blind to represent the blind. The sighted people can do that too. And I think a lot of people might find that a little odd, but I don't find it odd.
I don't think that a doctor that treats heart patients has to be a doctor that's had a heart attack. I don't think you have to have a heart attack to treat a heart patient and know all about it. Any more than I think you have to be blind to be able to serve blind people.
Yes, I couldn't agree with you more. Let's move on to the rest of your life. You later became a part of the Child Services Department in Maine. And how did that go? How did you operate there?
Okay, by then, of course, computer access was... equipment, you know, voice and braille output, printers, and that was out then. So anyway, I had worked down there for over 20 years at Human Services, and there again, just lucky, I guess, we met the right people. So I knew the guy that was the director of the Division of Child Support. So one day we're talking, and I'm saying, geez, Jack, I said, I think I got to give this thing up. I said, geez, my legs and my knees and everything, you know, they're really getting to me after all these years on these cement floors and stuff. So, you know, it was just casual conversation. So went along a while, and he came down one day, and he said to me, he said, you still planning on getting down here? And I said, yeah, I said, I'm thinking about it. When are you getting done? I said, the end of June. Oh, he says, I said, I haven't let the boss know. I said, you know, don't spread that around. He said, oh, no. So after, like I said, about a few more weeks went by, and by that time I'd sent a letter to the division telling him I was resigning as an assistant operator. And he come down a little later. One afternoon, it was kind of quiet, and he leaned over the counter, and he said, look, he said, you go up there and take some tests. He said, the legislature has just approved, and I can't remember how many positions, at 38, 28, but it was a lot of new positions for his department, Division of Child Support Enforcement. You go up there and take some tests, he says. So I did. And that's where I wound up. But there again, it wasn't what I knew. It was knowing the right guy, and he was it.
I want you to tell us how your resume was fixed up by this new boss you were going to have. Tell us how resumes get altered and put through. I think people would be interested in hearing that.
Yeah, well, I applied for the quick positions and so forth, and that was all right. I didn't have any problem with that. But I had applied for an agent's position, too. Well, I sent the application out and gave them my background, you know, what they asked for on the application. And they sent me a letter back and said I wasn't qualified. So anyway, there again, a couple of days, and Jack came around, and I showed him the letter. I said, they told me, they said, I'm not qualified, Jack. Therefore, well, I ain't going to say what he said, but let me see that, he said. So he took that letter. A couple days later, he come back, and this wouldn't happen again in 100 years. He come back with a resume. Well, he'd asked me some questions before. Now, look, you've been president of that. I didn't get into that, but I wound up as president of the main center for the blind after a while. And that's, what kind of budget they got? Well, they got over $1 million. Geez, he put that all down, you know. And he did me a resume, because I didn't believe it was me when he brought it back. Now he says, you send an application up there. And he said, send that with it. And I did. And they sent back and said, oh, yeah, you're qualified. So I took the test. I did. I never made it to be agent, but I took the test anyway.
Yes, and there again is a real good object lesson. It's not what you know sometimes, but who you know and who can help. And you had these people who wanted to help you, who liked you, who you persuaded to help them. Well, I don't know if you persuaded them, but you reached out to them. They found something interesting, important about you, and they wanted to help you and blind people. And it is a great search you did, Uncle G, and you've never received any recognition for that. I hope this interview give the recognition you richly deserve.
Well, I thank you, Lou. But I want to point out to those who might still be here, those who haven't fallen asleep and so forth, exposure. Get out there and meet people. You never know, and then people are going to be able to help you. Let them know that you're blind, but that you can do stuff. That you're not mentally retarded. That you can work, and that's what it's all about, getting out there and meeting people.
I'm glad you said that. That's an important message you just gave. Yeah, getting out there, meeting people, coming out of your shell, even though it is uncomfortable, it's awkward many times, right? It's embarrassing, but you have to do it. You have to constantly reach there. Let's move, unless you want to say more about that, Uncle G, let's move on to some of the things that you like to do and that you have done.
You want to know, I guess you broke up there. I guess what you want to know is what I like to do. Well, since I've retired, I like to do quite a lot of traveling. I know some people say, well, what does it do? You can't see it. Well, you've got to do it to understand it. There's a feeling. There's more than just seeing things. There's a feeling about being in different places and doing different things. And we do some of that. Other than that, I guess, you know, I have a house here. It's got 6 rooms that I have to take care of. It takes some doing. I don't know if that's one of the things I like to do, but of course, Jennifer knows one of the things I like to do is laundry. But the thing I like to do, I'm doing right now. One of the things is I'm doing right now, Lou.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that. And you like music, you like travel, And I guess you like to talk, don't you, Uncle G? And you do that pretty well. In the closing moments, is there anything that you'd like to cover that I wasn't able to cover or was not enough to think about and argue about? You have the floor.
Well, I don't think so, Lou. I mean, the rest of it is just details about how things happened and so forth. Like I said, I mentioned there, from a guy that got kicked out of the main center for the blind to a guy that became president for 2 years. I mean, that was one of my great victories, I think. Real great satisfactions, Lou. You can think of, well, you must be satisfied you was able to work and bought a house and did all that stuff, and that's true. But I don't know, when I reflect on all the the things I'd done, places I'd been, I guess probably that I just mentioned there about the main center, like I said, from a guy that was asked to leave to a guy that became president for 2 years, I guess I enjoy thinking about that about as much as I do anything.
Yeah, I think you ought to. No one's going to probably remember you after you pass away. But the point I want to make is you did these things, and you just came to the surface. You didn't get into all the bills that you had, all the things you did, all the meetings you had with the legislature. How effective you were behind the scenes. No one knows that. Yet, it's people like you who move, who push the move forward, the movement, the blind consumer movement, get something done to help people, not just with your living, but for decades after you're gone and I'm gone. And my hat goes off to you. I certainly admire what you've done and the way you've done it. And I really appreciate you coming on and telling us about your life and your victories.
Well, I like to think that I was helpful, that we've got more services today for the blind than we had when I first was involved. I like to think that. I don't know how true it is, but I like to think that. And Maine isn't a bad state for services now. There are states that are a lot worse off than we are. I think our next big fight here is going to be for a commission for the blind. I think that's coming. But there again, we can't do everything overnight. Progress takes time, it's slow, and we have to be patient.
Well, you've certainly been a patient man, and when you think back where blind services were back in the 50s and where they are now, you and people like you have moved mountains, literally mountains. Again, I want to thank you for coming on, Uncle G, and educating us, enlightening us on how the real world works in legislative process, and how an individual like you, who didn't have much visibility, didn't have any social opponents, got so much done so quietly over all those years. Thank you. And I'm sure you did something for the handicapped. Other handicapped people as well. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure, Lou.